D. McKinley, welcome.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, you've given much of your life to civil rights and social justice, originally from your girlhood home in Bessemer, mm-hmm. Alabama. You note that it began in the era of the civil rights marches, and you were a 15-year-old youth volunteer with the Voters League. So let's start right there.
Okay.
What sparked that flame in you?
Well, they needed someone to stuff envelopes because, of course, we were mailing envelopes to encourage people to get out to vote. And so doing that and seeing the response of the people that sent their information back to the Voters League, I thought we were on to something then. So I said, okay, I like doing this.
Good
and that's
for you.
Been it. Yes, that's
for
been
one
it.
So young. That's something. So defining moments.
Mm-hmm.
Why then? Why march at all? You were a kid. Who were your big inspirations, role models on the rise at that time?
Well, I was a kid and I had seen the Klan march down my street. And we had talked about we needed to get some changes done, that we need not be afraid of those men in the sheets or whatever. That was during the time when the marches were taking place all over the U.S., basically. And we heard that it was coming to our city. So the ones who were coming were the Dr. Martin Luther Kings, the Bevels, the Lewises, and all of those, the Vivians, and all of those were on their way to our city. Now, Dr. King's brother, A.D. King, lived in Birmingham, and then Fred Shuttlesworth. Those were particular leaders in and around our city. So we just, as young people, you know how young people are. You dare us to do something, and we're going to do it.
The world is glad for your obstinacy, maybe, mm-hmm, or your defiance. And moving forward to spring of 1963, and that would be the march in Birmingham.
Mm-hmm.
Please set the scene for us. What was foremost on that national agenda as well as your own?
Right. Well, we heard that, as I said earlier, that the leaders were coming to Birmingham. Dr. King was in New York. And we had read that he said that the movement was dying, and it would have died if it had not been for the youth. James Bevels came to the city of Birmingham, went to Parker High School, got the students out of school to participate in the marches, and we said we wanted to do that too. So we decided that we were going to go to Birmingham and participate in the civil rights movement. We said that we were not going to just sit still. We were going to go and be a part of the action, as we called it. So we left school one morning, starting out walking to Birmingham. We got a ride because Birmingham was like 13 miles away. But we were determined if we didn't get a ride, we were going to go anyway. And so that was the first day that we went. We went and we sang songs and chanted and did all of that and got a ride back home before our parents knew that we were gone.
So far, so good on getting your cause done, parents.
Right.
Not a clue.
Parents told us, most of the parents told us, don't get in that mess. You know, don't get in that mess, you know. And I think I was at that time more afraid of my father than I was of Bull Connor. So, you know, if he said don't get in it, we had to sneakily get in it, you know.
Okay, by then, there's another big march,
mm-hmm,
and a big statement that was Selma to Montgomery.
Mm-hmm.
And another strong figure heading it all up, that was John Lewis.
That was John Lewis. After we had encountered the fire hose and the dogs in March of 1963 in the city of Birmingham, you know, where the dogs were let loose on us and the fire hose, as a result of an order from Bull Connor, the commissioner at that time of police. And then, you know, we heard that, okay, there's going to be another march, and we were going to march in Selma, and we were going to go from Selma to Montgomery for encouraging as a voters' rights thing. In Birmingham, we were dealing with civil rights. In other words, we were trying to get the rights that were already ours, in a sense. But we had to fight for them. And then so now we had to fight for the poll because of all the discrimination that was taking place for voters, black voters, to just get the right to vote. all of the craziness about the poll tax and questions that were being asked, and to tell you, no, you didn't pass, so you didn't have the right to vote. So in come John Lewis, along with the others, but John Lewis was the one who was to plan that march and to lead that march. You know, he got the blessings from Dr. King that he would be the leader of the march. And so because he was young and we were young, we wanted to be with him as well. So we again had to sneak away and do this again.
So what did Lewis add to the impetus and determination and message that Bevels and Dr. King were certainly broadcasting, but what was special about Lewis?
Lewis was such a quiet, gentle giant, in a sense. Lewis would make you give him your last bite of food. In other words, the way that he would talk, he could convince you to do, you know, what you say. Well, I don't think I can do that. I don't think I want to do that. But his soft-spokenness and his determination that, you know, we are going to do this. This was happening because he had been participating. He had been hurt. He had been, you know, hit. He had been, a lot of things had happened to him, but he still was so gentle and so kind. And the thing is that a lot of people a long time thought it was just blacks who were marching across the bridge, but it was not. It was black and white. It was everybody who wanted to see a change for all of God's children, and that included us.
And that's certainly important to remember. The country wanted to see a change, at
definitely
least the best and greatest part of it, we might say.
Absolutely. And this was the time when President Kennedy, President Johnson, you know, I don't know if they had to do what they did, but I'm glad they did. He sent the troops to Alabama to do a lot. And then because of all that was going on, it ended up with the Civil Rights Bill of 64 and the Voters Rights Bill. So, you know, something came out of the deaths and the beatings and all of that for that cause. We saw that happen.
Quite a price, but it's quite a goal.
Yes. And it could have easily have been me as one of those who died, but you know, God spared me. So I'm thankful for that because mm-hmm. he had much more work for me to do.
Mm-hmm. Mm. Now back to this march.
Mm-hmm.
It was called the demonstration, turned into Bloody Sunday
mm-hmm.
at a critical point in this time, space, momentum. My, can you share a glimmer of the passion, the purpose, the intensity of it all?
It was like a family gathering, you know, it was like, come on and join us, you know, don't leave anybody out. Even though we were children, in a sense, the adults were so loving and kind and pulled us right along with them. Now, I wished I could have been up as close as John Lewis, you know, right there with everybody else. But, you know, we were kind of like further back, etc. And probably for the best because, you know, I would have been running my mouth and probably got in more trouble. But it was such a time, you know, it's just almost so hard to explain what was going on in our minds as young people to be a part of that. And then the first time, you know, didn't anything happen. But then the second time, you know, when we crossed the bridge and we didn't get to the bottom of the bridge because we were still on the bridge, you know. So when the gas and the horses and all of that and the billy clubs and all of that, we were far back. Naturally, when that started happening, we all scattered. So we ran back to the church. And that's where, after Lewis was hit with the billy club, he came back there too. And they took him to the hospital from there.
It had to be
a Bloody Sunday.
Yeah, it had to be hard to comprehend.
Oh, my God. We cried because we didn't know what was going to happen. And then we started looking at each other and saying, you know, what would our parents think? Because we were not in the place we were supposed to have been at. So, you know.
Is this the time the parents finally realized what you folks had been
to? Yeah, you know, when my dad came to get me out of Rigwood Field, because that's where, in the dugout where they put the young people who were arrested for demonstrating. And when he came to get me, I said, oh, my God, I didn't even want to go with him because, like I said, I was more afraid of James McKinley than I was of Bull Connor. So, you know, I was just saying, oh, please don't let him, don't let him. And that was the longest ride. It was 13 miles, but it was the longest ride home because all he did, and my dad smoked or chewed a cigar. So all he did, he just kept chewing on that cigar and humming a song and not saying anything. And that was like a death sentence. To not say anything. And then because, you know, I just knew back in the day they could whip us, you know, so I just knew I was trying to get the whipping of my life. And the situation that happened right then was that when he got home, he said, go in there and go to bed. And, you know, we've been known to go to bed and then they whip us up because, you know, something we had done. So we just knew that's what was going to happen. But I heard him say to my mom how proud he was that we did go. But he wouldn't tell us that. But he said it to our mom because he thought we would sleep by then, you know. When he said that, I was determined then. It was nothing stopping me at all.
Oh, my goodness. So after that, not really. So after that incredible journey so far, the incredible story, when you finally got to hear the great John Lewis's speech after that as well, what did it say to the world, Dee?
It said that there has to be a change and that we have to take responsibility in causing that to change. So it has to be a change by not just Black people. It had to be a change by every people in the whole world. In other words, because people should be treated the way the oppressors want to be treated. So in other words, why can't you treat me like you want to be treated? And as a result of that, I say coming out of Washington, oh, it's on now. Oh, yeah. We just heard a very powerful speech by a young man. And Dr. King and C.T. Vivens and all of them were awesome. Because of the youth, because of the age, because of the dynamics of a young person who was brave enough to stick his neck out, we felt that we could do it too.
And it rocked your world.
Oh my God. It was on. It was on. I was forward marching. That's where I was going. And I don't know where these little feet were going to lead me, but I tell you, I was ready to go.
Well, then let's move on, as you did, because you did move to Fort Wayne. And how did that become your new home?
Well, what happened was I came to Fort Wayne to visit my relatives. You know, they said everybody come from Alabama moved to Fort Wayne. So I came up to visit my relatives. And it was during the time when the boycott of Fort Wayne Community Schools was going on. And there were freedom schools in the church basements of a lot of our pastors. And as a result, my pastor, Pastor Samuel Walker, my cousin at that time was not my pastor because I was not going to stay, was participating in the Freedom Schools. And so he said, well, Dolores, you just graduated from college, so I know you can help do this. You know, you said you're going to be here about a month, you know, and I was going to be here about a month. And then I was going back south so that I can go to graduate school in Atlanta, Georgia. So he said, well, we need you here. And in 2 weeks, I was hooked. I guess I drank the water and I was never going to leave. But I participated in working with the Freedom Schools. That's how I got to Fort Wayne and loved to stay here because I had just come out of the movement in Birmingham. And I said that in Birmingham and other parts of Alabama that it felt right at home because it was a boycott. You know, we are again fighting for something that was needed at that time. So that was just down my alley.
We're glad it was, to be sure. And okay, the year was 1969. What was the state of social justice and civil rights all the way up here then?
Well, the difference in the two was down south, you know, they told you they don't like niggas. And so therefore, and they said that directly to your face. Up south, which is Fort Wayne, you know, they'll smile in your face, but stab you in the back in a sense. You know, they act like they like that you are where you are, but they really didn't. So, you know, we had to keep fighting and pulling teeth. And God just put you in a place that you ought to be I had the opportunity to work for the Fort Wayne Urban League under one of the greatest directors and city councilmen, and that was Charles Redd. Charles was one who said, get out and go get the vote. It's like clocking in, but you're going out. In other words, he said, wherever people were, you need to go there. And you need to find out if they're registered to vote. And if they're not, you know, we were voter registrars, so we registered them to vote. We probably shouldn't have been registering them in the bars and whatever, but, you know, we ended up in the bars and all that. That was my Crown Royal days. So we registered people in Kim's Corner, at the Legion, and other points that we knew people would be. And that's what, you know, got me really geared up for civil rights in Fort Wayne under the tutelage of one Mr. Charles Redd.
Charles Redd is yet another beloved benefactor to Fort Wayne. Mm-hmm. All people, all the time.
All the time.
And that's pretty amazing.
Yes.
Besides the Urban League and Charles Redd, mm-hmm. talk about two good introductions into this wonderful world that you still rule in a lot of ways. How did you immerse yourself into the heart and core? Keep going from there.
Yes. Well, one of the things, once I left the Urban League, I applied for a job at Metro Human Relations Commission. And at that time, my director was John Beams. You know John Beams. So I got to be an investigator for Metro Human Relations Commission, investigating discrimination based on race, sex, national origin, ancestry, all of that. And having an opportunity to go into companies to try to find out why you're treating people differently because of their race or because of their sex or whatever. So that was my intro into that. And that was under the leadership of a great mayor of the city of Fort Wayne. And it started off with Ivan Leminoff. And my next great mayor of the city of Fort Wayne was Win Moses. So a lot of changes took place during that time. And it also took place with me. I went from investigator to deputy director under the leadership of Jim Graham. And then eventually when Jim left, I became director of Metro. I was glad to be director of Metro because if we did not have a complainant to come in to voice their concern about discrimination on their job, then I became the complainant because I had the power through the ordinance to file a director's complaint. And I used to love to file director's complaints, which simply said, we know you're discriminating. And even though won't anybody come forward and say anything, as the director, I become the complainant, so I can file a complaint against you. And what that did throughout the city of Fort Wayne, that gave us an opportunity to become educators to our employers, to our realtors, you know, to all parts of our discrimination that we could investigate under the ordinance. And I would rather educate than investigate. And that was always my thing. Let's educate and not investigate. But if we educate you and you still do what you do, then we're going to investigate you. And that, you know, that was the highlight, really, doing that as a director of Metro Human Relations Commission.
As you move through your life and continue to add roles and hats and job skills and everything else, you have had an incredible journey. We know that.
Yes.
Were you ever discouraged or just fed up to a point that you couldn't see straight, mad, upset, sad?
Of course I was. It was so much housing discrimination. I think that was the thing that got me more so than employment discrimination. And it was so much blockbusting going on, and it was so much redlining going on. And I almost wanted to throw up my hands and just quit that and go find something else. But then we started doing housing tests, and we had a realtor who we knew was busting up a block, you know, sending people to say, you know, who's moving next to you, and whoever is, you know, that when they move in, your property value is going to go down. And we knew that that was what that real estate company was doing. So I invited the president of that company to come and sit down and talk with us so that we can, you know, let you know we know what's going on, but we want to educate you. We want to tell you about this. And he said, I'm not coming up there to talk to no D. McKinley. He called me a queen bee. I'm not going to go and talk to this queen bee. And I said, fine. So I called back and I told his secretary he could meet me tomorrow and talk with me, or he can talk with Housing and Urban Development. I was calling HUD. And we met. He became one of the greatest supporters of the Housing Discrimination Act, you know, under HUD. He became one of the leaders to talk to other real estate agencies simply because of that conversation. And that was one of the greatest moments I can remember in my life during Metro Human Relations Commission.
Oh, my goodness.
Housing discrimination is prevalent right now, you know, and it almost make me want to put on my shoes and hit the road doing some tests because it's going on, kind of like almost come full circle.
Indeed. And are you, if not satisfied, are you at least watching carefully and hopeful that it's going to be redirected or busted?
Hopefully,
or...
if not, you know, I'll be a one-person sign holder saying you better get it together or, you know, we're coming in with the feds because it's going on.
And it can't. No, it can't.
Yes, we can't go back. We can't go back.
Okay, Dee, one thing, as we continue this conversation, I do have to ask, since you could have gone in many directions and have, eventually, of course, truly formally teaching into the school system became your thing. What does the role of teacher, educator afford you that nothing else can, even the other things in your life?
Yeah, well, the thing in the school system, I am a case manager. Case manager is a teacher. Yeah, as a case manager, I find myself being the teacher, the mother, the provider, all of those. I wear all of those hats as a case manager because my job is to make sure that the child is safe, has food to eat, has clothes to wear. And in doing that, you can't do that for the child without getting involved with the families. So I love my families because of the fact that I want the best for the kid. And so in wanting the best for the child, I keep calling them kids, but wanting the best for the child, you have to get in good graces with the parent. You know, where the parents would trust you, you know, trust you with their child, where the parents would call you even on a weekend, some kind of way they'll find you and say, my child is clowning, my child is acting up, I need you to talk to them. And I said, put them on the phone, you know, and I give them the D. McKinley Act and they know to get their act together. That's the good thing that I love about working in education. Because I believe that if we can teach them now, when they get older, when we teach them the right thing, when they get older, they become better citizens in our community. And not only that, but it redirects the parents who might not know how to parent. And then we have to teach them how to do this. You know, these are things you need to do. These are things you do with your child. Don't just ask them, how was your day? They're going to say, great. Have a conversation. Tell me about your day, you know. And so in being case manager, you know, that means finding coats. That means finding uniforms. That means finding school supplies. It just whatever the child needs to make the child a whole child, which means it's less on a parent. And I love that.
It's generational as well. I get that. And face it, Dee, you're a fixer.
Oh, yeah. Oh, thank God for that. I can't fix everything, but those things I can fix, I fix those.
You certainly do. And jumping back out of your education role in history for just a second, what do you think the most important things that you can do from those platforms that do support civil and social justice to complement the rest of your overall life mission?
I think that what I can do is that where I see that there's a need and I can lend a hand to do that, I don't think that I have the or should take the opportunity that if I disagree with somebody to become disagreeable. I mean, I should be able to listen to other people and see where they're going. And if I think that I can add something to where they're going, I definitely want to do that. And if I think I can't, then I have to have sense enough to back away from that. So it's one of the things, you know, that we say, Lord, help me to know what it is that I can do, and then what I should do, and what I can't do, back away from it. And I may not be the answer, but if there's somebody with the answer, then I should be one to lead them to that person. Because all answers is not in one person's head. But I think from my experience, I can tell you about this, I can tell you about that, and I can tell you about that. But we're living in a new day. So some what I did, they may not hear it. But if there's a younger person, which is the same thing that was going on with me back in the day, if I can lead them to a person who can direct them, then let's do that. Nobody's trying to take credit for anything if it makes the world better to live in. It's all of our job.
Then it's all connections.
It's all connections.
You're certainly about that. Speaking of those, and speaking about your God, how does your whole life in praise music, radio host, keep you going strong and, in fact, your constituency?
If it were not for the music that I play, oh my God. I mean, it's more for me than the people that listens to the music. But, you know, I serve a God who does everything, and he does the impossible. And the impossible for me would have been, you know, I'm not getting up every Sunday morning to be on air at 4 a.m., which means I got to get up about 2:30 in order to get to the station. But the thing is that the compliments and the calls that I would get of people who say, you know, that song made my day, or I was thinking about killing myself and you put that song on and it changed my life. I thank you for that. And you run into people who said, hey, I listened to the show Sunday. Thank you. I made a step that I thought I wouldn't make a step to. And the music put me in the mode to go on and do that. And I play Sunday school lessons also, you know, so there's scripture that goes along with the music that I play. And everybody say, well, you've been doing this. I'll be going into my 46th year. And they said, aren't you tired of doing that? I'll never tire of playing good gospel music. As long as the Lord gives me the strength, I'm going to do that. But see, I leave here at 8 o'clock and make my way to Joshua's Temple over at 4202 Hesson Castle Road with Prophet Cedric Lee Walker. That's my day. I go from here to church and then fellowship with my brothers and sisters. You know, if I couldn't do that, in some countries you can't do that. If I couldn't do it, I don't know where I would be. And then, you know, working with kids, keep me going, keep me alive, as I say, gives me that strength. I don't know. You know, sometimes when people retire and they just go somewhere and sit down, they kind of like tick away. I want to be found working before I go out here. I hope that when the Lord calls me, he calls me while I'm doing this kind of work.
Dee, we all do too. And if we had to bet where you're going to be out there somewhere.
Look for me.
Yes, yes. And take care of that business first.
Oh, yes.
So your life of extraordinary service is beyond commendable. And you are seemingly unstoppable. Besides the pure Dee that got you here to this place in time, how have John Lewis and his contemporaries directly influenced your journey, the direct course that has led you to do this much for so many?
If it had not been for this opportunity to sit under the tutelage of John Lewis and the Dr. Martin Luther Kings and the C.T. Vivians and Miss Nash and Bevels and all of them, I don't know what I would be doing. But I am sure that it was God's divine pointing me in that direction to do this. When I saw what they were doing, I wanted to do the same thing. I wouldn't think of if I would make it or whatever, none of that. But I would step out on faith and keep doing what it is that I saw them do. Every child needs to have a mentor or someone that they look up to. Besides my parents, those were the people who said, get in it and stay in it. Never give up. Never take no for an answer. You may have to receive the no at that time and back away, But God gives you a way to go back to the no and get that change to a yes. That is what they did for me. That is I've been a fighter for people's rights as long as I've been in Fort Wayne and even before then. Because I think that every person deserves an opportunity. There will be some disappointments. I am sure that John and Martin and James and all of them ran into many disappointments by their own people, you know. But the thing is that didn't stop them. And those were the kinds of things that I reflect on that said, if they could do it, you can do it too.
Dee McKinley is a social advocate, case manager at Fort Wayne Community Schools, radio host, local legend. Dee, we are honored to share you and your story with our listeners. Never stop showing us the way. Never take no for an answer, and no. Do carry the gift.
Thank you so much.